Jaws 2. The terror continues.
In all the vast and unknown depths of the ocean, how could there have been only one?
Chief Brody, can we go, please?
I think we may have another shark problem. Are you serious?
Roy Scheider.
Hey, look, there's my dad!
The whole beach looks incredible.
Lorraine Gary. And Murray Hamilton.
Look at this. That's a shark.
You started a panic on a public beach. Now, what if somebody decides to sue us? That's a shark. Did you ever stop to think about that?
And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one because I don't intend to go through that hell again.
Don't press it this time.
Mike is out there.
Man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's that time of year again, namely the 4th of July, and that means we are talking Jaws, in this case, Jaws 2, and joining me once again is my pal and the biggest Jaws fan I know, Dan Colon. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on again. This is,
well,
this time of year is one of my favorites, as you know. It's like Christmas.
We did joke last year when we did our Jaws audio commentary that we should do this every July 3rd, because, of course, tomorrow, for Christ's sakes, is the 4th of July. And since there are a bunch of Jaws movies to get through, I don't know how serious we were about it, but we're here. We're here to talk Jaws too. So,
yeah. People have varying opinions on the Jaws, sequels. And, you know, I mean, that's putting it mildly. I actually really like all of them to varying degrees. If I'm being perfectly honest, I think that, they're not very good. But that's not to say I don't get enjoyment out of them. You know, I watch a lot of trash, and I think they're as bad as they are. They're perfectly fun. You know, so and I think that's okay. I think that's all they need to be. It's just, you know, I think people are always going to compare them to the original, and that's just what's going to happen. And yeah, of course they're going to pale in comparison, but I don't think that's necessarily to suggest that there's nothing fun to take from them. And of the sequels, I think Jaws 2 is probably the best.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll get into the nitty gritty of all that over the course of the next 2 hours as we talk over Jaws 2. All right, everybody. So if you're going to watch the movie along with us, it's going to sync it up. We're going to do 3, 2, 1 and then go. And on the go, Dan and I are going to start watching Jaws 2. So Dan, if you're ready, we will get rolling.
Let's do it.
All right, so 3, 2, 1, go. So Jaws 2 came out on June 16th, 1978, and I have distinct memories of seeing this movie in the theater with my dad and my sister at the Neshaminy Mall in Pennsylvania. And so I was pretty scared by this movie. I mean, I think it's much more of a horror film than the first film is. The first film is kind of a horror adventure. But I think this is straight up horror. And of course, I would have not even have been 7 when I saw this. So it's a pretty scary movie for a 7-year-old to take in.
Yeah, this I found has almost like a slasher film quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more interested in the body count than the its predecessor.
Yes.
And it's weird to say that it's got like a slasher vibe going on, because in 1978, there weren't really, like, slasher wasn't a genre yet.
Right,
really.
Right.
I mean, there was Black Christmas, and John Carpenter's Halloween had not yet come out. You know, you had, what else? What would have come out before that? I'm trying to think.
Not a whole lot. No, there was no Jason. Yeah, there was.
Right.
Yeah.
So it certainly wasn't an established genre, but they definitely, but by modern standards, it definitely has a lot of that same stuff going on. And I think that's interesting. I was watching an interview with the director, Jeannot Zwark.
Yes.
And, you know, his whole idea when he came on board was to show the shark as much as possible.
Yep.
Which, and I think we can argue whether that was a good or bad idea. I see why he wanted to do that, because the first movie had done it a certain way, and the shark wasn't a surprise anymore. So he figured, why try to replicate that? Let's lean into what people want to see, which is the shark, and just show it a bunch. I don't know that that's necessarily the best choice. I think he was probably his heart was in the right place. I don't know that it was the best, but yeah, this movie is a lot more in your face, and there's a lot more, you know, just a lot of screaming.
Yeah, there's a lot of screaming. Yeah,
a lot of carnage, and you know, it's. I don't know. We I guess we'll debate whether or not that was a good thing or bad thing. I definitely appreciate where he was coming from, though. I think that his intent was good, even if the execution wasn't as good as it could have been.
Yeah, I mean, he for all the criticisms aimed at this movie, deserved or undeserved, he certainly was under the gun at the making of this film. I mean, for people who don't know, they originally tapped the director John D. Hancock to direct this movie. John D. Hancock had done films like Bang the Drum Slowly, Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which is actually a pretty good, very low-key horror film. And he apparently wanted to do something. Oh, by the way, this opening is really good with the camera fluttering, taking pictures of the shark.
I actually really love this opening.
Yeah, this is actually a really good opening. These scuba divers getting attacked, and you don't see what's attacking them, but the camera, because it's falling, is taking pictures. That's a very effective opening. I got to say, that's a good opening. But anyway, John D. Hancock wanted to do this kind of moody thing, which showed how much Amity, the town, had been destroyed financially by this shark. And he had apparently shot a good amount of footage, and he showed it to Universal, and Universal just was like, no. This is not what we asked for. We wanted something a little pulpier, a little more fun, because, of course, Jaws had been, for a year or two, the most successful film of all time until Star Wars came along. And that's not what they wanted. So they fired Hancock off the movie and replaced him at the last minute with Jeannot Zwark. And Jeannot Zwark and Roy Scheider did not get along at all. And Roy Scheider did not want to be here. Dan, I know you know this story. Why don't you share why he does not want to be in this movie?
Yeah, I was going to say, Roy Scheider was already in a bad mood when he came onto this film. So, I mean, whether or not he would have gotten along with Jeannot to begin with, you know, who's to say? But he already just didn't want to be in this movie. And I think you can see some of that in his performance, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he was... he was contracted with Universal for The Deer Hunter.
Right.
And he backed out of The Deer Hunter. I don't know actually the details of why he did that. I can't remember the specifics. But because he backed out of The Deer Hunter, he still owed them a movie. And he agreed to do Jaws 2 just to get himself out of that contract.
Yep.
So, yeah, do you know why he backed out of The Deer Hunter?
No, I don't know why. I mean, that film was a certainly renowned film. I'm kind of surprised that he would have bailed out of that. And apparently he owed Universal two films, and they wanted him in Jaws 2 so bad that they said, if you do Jaws 2, we'll count it as both films. So he was like, okay. And one of the problems I think that inherently with this movie, and you see right in the opening credits, is that right after Roy Scheider, the next two names are Lorraine Gary and Murray Hamilton, of course, his wife and Mayor Vaughn. But part of the problem is they're on the poster in the same places in the poster that previously occupied by Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw. I think part of the problem is those characters aren't really that interesting,
but
they deserve to be bumped up to co-leads. And that is part of the issue. I think they didn't find a way to find other characters to come in here and make this story more interesting. Because look, I love Mayor Vaughn. I know you love Mayor Vaughn. Everyone loves Mayor Vaughn. But should he be the third lead in a Jaws movie? No, he's a side character, and he just isn't built for getting much more screen time.
Right. Yeah. The thing that surprises me about this movie is just how many of those.
There he is.
There are. Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's like, yeah, you're right. There's no reason. Even all of the selectmen are yeah. They got Harry to come back. And, you know, so it's, I feel like that's sort of what I'm looking for. Like that is in keeping with a lot of this movie in general, in that I feel like they had this small idea and really stretched it to its limit.
Yep.
You know, which is wild, because I've read, or I've heard stories, like when Jaws was a hit, their immediate thought was, okay, we have to make a sequel. And Peter Benchley had some ideas for a sequel. Arthur C. Clarke had some ideas for a sequel.
Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah. So, like, they had all of these potential sources, and ultimately they went back to Carl Gottlieb, who, again, on this second film, was rewriting the script as they were shooting the film. But, like, it's a wonder why they felt the need to really hold on to the previous film the way they do. I get sticking with the Brodies. I think the Brodies are a natural, you know, they're the natural protagonists of this film. But yeah, there's so much of it that is even the marketing. I said something on Facebook the other day about even the marketing is just, they're just coasting on the success of that previous film. And they're going to try and keep as much of that as possible, just to, I guess, keep people in their seats when they could have done anything. You know, I think they could have done a lot of things with this story. It's strange that they bring, man, why is Harry in this movie as much as he is? Why is Lorraine Gary such a prominent character in this film? I'm not.
Well, I think that's probably because she was married to Stu Scheinberg, the head of Universal.
Well, that's the real answer, right?
Yeah.
You know, I can't find any reason why Ellen Brody needs to have such a huge role in this movie.
No. I mean, merchandising-wise, you mentioned of course, this film has one of the greatest taglines ever in movie history, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Yes.
Which is so famous. That was such a part of the culture when I was a kid that I always ascribed it. I just sort of thought of it as the Jaws tagline, even though, of course, it's not the Jaws tagline. It's the Jaws 2 tagline.
Right.
But that's how preeminent it was. It was parodied over and over again. It was just part of the culture. It was just a line that kids my age used to refer to different things. And so here we're getting introduced to a bunch of the characters. We've got Mark Gruner as Mike here on the left-hand side of the screen. This is his final film. He was only in a handful of movies. And then we saw, I think Gary Springer was one of the other kids there at the punch bowl.
And don't forget Keith Gordon.
And Keith Gordon, of course, future director and son of Rodney Dangerfield and Back to School. Keith Gordon is in this movie. Joseph Mascolo, who plays Peterson, he was in a bunch of stuff like Hulk, The Rockford Files, mostly a soap opera actor. He passed away a couple years ago. He did a lot of runs on General Hospital, Days of Our Lives, and stuff like that. But he's basically kind of the new Mayor Vaughn character,
sure,
in this movie, because he's the one who's butting heads with Roy Scheider. And, you know, you mentioned the other ideas for this film, and apparently, I think it was Howard Sackler's idea, said they were going to do a prequel and make the Indianapolis film, make a film out of the story that Quint tells.
Right.
And apparently that was something that Spielberg might have been interested in. But
that's the only Jaws sequel idea I've ever heard him express any interest in whatsoever.
Yeah, but Sid Sheinberg was like, no. And look, Roy Scheider's great in the first movie. That's not a bulletin. But I do wonder why they felt the need to keep it in Amity. Because obviously you could have followed Hooper on his adventures in the Aurora. And there's even a line referencing that in this film. I feel like that's a more natural sequel than another shark attacks the same little island.
Right. Yeah. As I mentioned, there were a couple other sources for new script ideas. And Arthur, I don't know the specific details of Arthur C. Clarke's idea, but the producers, Zanuck and Brown, in the interview I watched, they sort of mentioned that it was a little too grandiose for what we're trying to do.
A giant monolith appears on Amity Island.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's true. Maybe because, you know, Arthur C. Clarke is a kind of a guy with a lot of heady ideas. Maybe it wouldn't have been great, but you know, I'd be interested to know what he would want to do with a Jaws sequel.
That's my reels of what that might have been.
Right. But yeah, instead, I mean, I get the inclination to want to keep it intimate, keep it about Brody. But you're right. I think that one of the things that's so great about the original Jaws is how much of that is an adventure film and a story about Matt Hooper out on the Aurora, out in the ocean, could have been a lot of fun to watch. If you want to follow one character, like that, I feel like is the natural way to go instead of Brody, who hates living on an island.
And you're just, again, you're just repeating of that. It's another shark attacking the island.
Correct.
You're just like, well, we already, isn't this a little silly? And yeah, I mean, it's hard to watch this film when you, oh, there's Jeffrey Kramer, Bob Dylan's future manager. I never miss opportunity to point that out.
I also learned Hendrix was not meant to be in this movie.
No, they brought him back.
Swark was such a big fan of his. And let's write Hendrix back into this movie. So they did. So, like, I can't imagine this movie without him.
He's got a big part. Again, he's another character that probably doesn't need this much screen time, but he gets a lot of it. It's hard to watch this movie knowing that Roy Scheider did not want to be here and not read it on his face. And maybe that's just because we already know something. You know, we're seeing something that isn't really there. But I feel like he just looks like he just doesn't want to be here. And apparently him and Swark really did not, and to the point where they got into a fist fight, which has got to be difficult circumstances, again, to make a movie.
Yeah.
When you're getting into a fist fight with your lead actor, for Pete's sakes. But he was just not, and you know, no offense to Mr. Swark, but I mean, his filmography, Somewhere in Time, Supergirl, Santa Claus, the movie, both those last two films made for the Salkinds. You know, this doesn't suggest someone of great directorial skill necessarily.
Sure, but at the time when Spielberg was hired, all he had really done was,
that's true,
he was a TV director
and he had one movie under his belt, so that's true.
Yeah. So he did, yeah, he had I think he had Sugarland Express,
yeah, yeah,
and Duel, and he had done some episodes in Night Gallery, and you know, I don't think if you compare those directors, like where they were in their careers at the time they got a Jaws movie, you know, I can see the similarities. You know, I don't think that comparatively that one is necessarily the obvious choice. But Spielberg, you know, we would learn in as his career progressed that how much of a genius he was.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, no, I don't necessarily think that was it. But I would love to know more about that conflict because. I know Swark was a guy who directed a lot of action, and the script was being rewritten, you know, by Carl Gottlieb, he would focus on the action sequences because he knew those were going to have to get shot, and then Carl Gottlieb was writing the connective tissue and developing the characters, the kids and Brody family and all that stuff, and I think that's a lot of the action in this movie works really well, so I don't know that Swark is the problem. It's just, I think Brody or Roy Scheider was just kind of over it. And, you know, but I mean, there's definitely more to it. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, the film I was most familiar with Swark directing is Supergirl, which is a terrible movie, but that isn't even necessarily his fault either. In some cases, there's some performances that are pretty bad, and those are usually the fault of the director. But it doesn't sound like Swark was handed a lot of great circumstances here. And I can only imagine how difficult this shoot must have been, again, to live in the shadow. I mean, there's a quote from him in the Marvel Super Special adaptation of this movie where he says, let's face it, Jaws 2 is not a picture that's going to be studied in film schools for years to come, and that applies to the first one as well. Well, all right, half that statement holds up, obviously. Now, he might have been kind of whistling past the graveyard a little bit in that he wanted to bring down the rep of the first film a little to be able to compare it a little more effectively with what he was doing. But obviously that isn't the case because now everyone knows Jaws is this renowned film, and it's one of the rare you know, blockbusters that also is critically lauded, and Jaws 2 is not so much that. So I could see maybe he was probably feeling a little defensive. Oh, here's the reintroduction of the camera that they found at the bottom of the ocean. So, but yeah, we've met most of our characters at this point, the teenagers, you know, I mean, it's the problem is, and this has got to be on a script stage, is just this guy. I love this guy. The drinker's nose this guy's got. That is, he's, I don't know what's going on there. But the problem is you just don't have, I mean, the first film has such a great triumvirate of like id, ego, and superego, and you just don't have that here. You just, it's poor Brody just kind of at, no pun intended, at sea. He's just, he's got nobody to bounce off of except for these incompetents.
Right.
His deputy, who isn't very good, who's kind of like a Barney Fife sort of thing, and Mayor Vaughn, and of course Mayor Vaughn, the subject of a great many memes to point out that even after his disastrous decisions in Jaws 1, he got reelected mayor for Jaws 2. So everybody, make sure you go vote this November.
Yeah, when we've talked about that, and we don't necessarily know how much time has passed between the first movie and the second movie. We don't know.
Well, Mike's a lot older, though.
Well, actually, do they? I think there is a line in here somewhere where they do mention his how long it's been. But if it's that much longer, I feel like it doesn't make as much sense for Brody to be so paranoid. The timeline's a little fuzzy.
Yeah, it is.
And, in the book, it's been 4 years. You know, I just read the book.
I can't wait to hear about what you discovered in that novelization of Jaws 2.
So, yeah, the thing I was most excited was to find the similarities, like the things that were kept. Because the book was based on the screenplay. And it sounds like it was based on the original screenplay in part because the town of Amity is kind of struggling.
Right.
And, you know, so all that element, which didn't make it into the movie, made it into the book. And the book is also set within the novel universe. So where the, in the first book where the mafia, the New York mafia is kind of an element in the story. They're the ones who are keeping pressure on the mayor to keep the businesses open. You know, it's not in the movie, it's just the mayor making a shitty decision, but in the book it's the mafia. They're an element that in the sequel, and you know, so that kind of makes it a little more pulpy and makes some of the story work a little better. But Brody is also on the outs in the book as well. He's applying pressure to this guy who shoots a seal on the beach.
Okay.
And he doesn't realize this guy is mob connected.
Oh, geez.
The more he pushes this guy to get brought up on charges, the more he gets pushed back on by the mayor, by the selectmen. You know, they're like, let it go, let it go, let it go. And so in the book, he's very much on his own, just like he is here, but for, you know, very different reasons.
Okay. Now we talked over the scene with the paraglider, which I actually think is pretty effective, where the paraglider keeps getting dunked into the water, and he doesn't realize that the shark is just, you know, a couple of feet below him, and then he gets dunked again, and the shark gets closer and closer, but then he gets saved when he gets pulled up at the last. Like that's a good tension builder, you know, because you're thinking oh, and then he gets away. You know, that guy gets away with it, so that's a good sequence. And now here's probably.
This is maybe the best scene.
You think the best kill? Well, in terms of what happens with the shark.
Yeah, this shot of the fin coming up out of the water is great.
And right there. There you go. Oh, boy.
Yeah. So I think of all the kills in this movie, this is probably the best orchestrated sequence. I think it's edited well. I think the music works great. And like that shot of the very quick fin really shows off how fast this thing is. I like this scene a lot.
And it's the poster image too. It's the poster. It's the girl on the skis with the shark behind her is the, that's the main poster basically. So yeah, we're watching this. Okay. We're just having a good time here. Just skating along.
Like a pro water skier, because apparently water skiing on the open ocean like this is very, very difficult.
Okay.
This is the choppy water.
Oh, here we go. Boom. Okay. Yep. She's down. Now, this takes a while, too. Again, this is always one of the more, you know, the idea of it taking that long to be eaten is grotesque. Yes. And now there's the woman. Like, oh, what happened to her? Okay, I'm going to turn around. See what goes on here.
This sequence is in the book as well, which I thought was pretty cool. Although it's like a man and his girlfriend or his wife.
Okay.
You know, like all of these characters, like this set of characters, the divers in the beginning, they're all characters in the book and have like a whole backstory. Like, I actually kind of admire the fact that they're given like full personalities and we know what their jobs are or like what their relationships are before they get mangled horribly by this giant shark. Whereas in the movie here, they just appear as like kind of, they're just here to increase the body count.
Yeah, they're just here to get knocked off. Yeah. So she sees the ski has got a big chomp mark out of it. That's not good. Here we go. Boom. Now, okay, one of the differences, until the very end of the first film, that shark, it doesn't seem to be so determined to just wreck shit. As opposed to this, here, you could dump the gas on herself. Show some competence, lady. This shark just wants to destroy everything. Here we go. Sets the flare. Sets yourself on fire. Look at that. Great. Boom.
It's a great fireball.
Oh, and here's old Mother Hubbard going, what the hell am I looking? What's going on out there? All right. Oh, what? By the way, that's actress Anne Dusenberry is the young girl there who was making out with the kid. I was looking her credit. She was in a Little Women TV miniseries just before this. I didn't know that existed even during all the talk of Little Women last in December, but the different version, but I never heard that one. She's in the film Cutter's Way with Jeff Bridges, which is a kind of a cult film, and Heartbeat with Nick Nolte and Sissy Spacek. She's done a lot of TV as we'll learn, almost all the actors except for Keith Gordon really didn't have much career after this. Like this, it's Hollywood's a rough business. Yep. Because this film, Jaws 2, ended up being the biggest hit of the year and the biggest sequel of all time until Empire Strikes Back. So once again, Spielberg and Lucas kept one-upping each other. But you would think that being in a film of this magnitude – I mean, I know it's the shark. That's the star of the movie. But it's kind of amazing to me that you can be in a movie that was the biggest hit of 1978 and it really – if the cards don't land right, it really doesn't do that much for your career.
Yeah, that's true. I know, you know, by this time, Murray Hamilton was pretty much done. He was on his way out filming this. His wife was having a biopsy, for cancer, I believe.
Yeah, and he wanted to get all the scenes
right. He didn't care about his career at that point. He just wanted to get out of there. So he filmed his scenes really quickly, left. And then I believe he did see the final film, but he died shortly after filming.
Did he really? I thought he lived longer than that. I didn't know that.
My understanding, I could be wrong. I can look it up. But my understanding is that he didn't really live much longer after Jaws 2.
He's in The Graduate, and it's fun to see him in The Graduate before, obviously The Graduate long before this, but it was fun to see. I always like when I see him pop up and stuff just because, yes. Oh, it's Mayor Vaughn here. Now, we're finding out that the setup here is that Chief Brody is taking this very seriously and no one else is. He told his deputy, go out and look, drag for the body, and he doesn't. He's bored. Now, here we go. This is the first indication of this is a big thing. Now, they never show you in this film, you never see the tail of the shark. So you never get any indication really of how big it is other than when the head pops up and it starts going after people. But, you know, in the first film, there's the line about that's a 20-footer, 25.
Right.
We don't get any sort of line like that here. The shark is just basically a fin and a head for the most part. We don't really get any sense of its –
Yeah. So real quick to address Murray Hamilton, he did live to the mid-80s, but he did.
There we go. Okay.
He did a lot of TV. His movie career was pretty much done.
Yeah, yeah.
So to address the shark, the book states that it is a 30-foot shark.
It's even bigger than the other one.
It's even bigger. It's also a female who is pregnant. And it's suggested that this shark is the mate of the original shark. But it's pregnant not with its offspring, because 4 years is a long time to be pregnant. Yeah, so the shark is a female and much bigger. Like, I think even the book says on the back, deadlier than the male, ..
Oh, Lord.
Oh, yeah, so it's supposed to be a much bigger shark. And the reason it attacks is because it is pregnant and is just kind of, like, needs to eat. It's looking for food sources everywhere. And it isn't so much out for revenge, which is interesting. I kind of thought that would have been the angle.
They would save that for the fourth film.
That's right.
By the way, we just passed over a giant commercial for Cheerios the Brody family sits down at breakfast, and there's a big, big, big shot of the box of Cheerios, and they even talk about Cheerios. So I'm imagining the Cheerios, got put some money in here and, got their product in the there was another shot of the box. Yeah, this was like took a weird commercial in the middle of this movie.
Yeah,
for Cheerios. So, but yeah, but Brody's the only one taking it seriously, because obviously he's been through this before, and no one else is following this. And then so here we go. Now we have the kids. Here we go. The kids are going to be frolicking around. That kid looks like the middle kid from the Brady Bunch. I know it's not, but he looks like him.
He's got Christopher Knight. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got that big mop of hair there. So we're playing around. So, okay. I mean, the Jaws novelization that you just mentioned, I mean, it was part of a huge – all the Jaws merchandise that you ever saw is not from the first film. It's from this film.
Right.
In anticipation of it. There was the game, of course, the ideal game, which I had, which is the giant shark. And you pull stuff out of the shark's mouth. And it
Yeah, you gifted me that once.
Yeah, you had that thing.
We talked about the last movie.
That's right. And then there were trading cards. Ooh, a big whale with a big bite out of it. Oh, that's ugly.
Not coincidentally, it is an orca.
An orca, right, of course. Another Peter another Peter Benchley book. Another movie that I saw, by the way. Oh, I also – boy, my dad
was
really
– Well, it was also the name of – it was also the name of Quint's boat.
Also the name of the Quint's boat. Yep. My dad took me to see The Deep, which was also a Peter Benchley book, and that movie's way too adult for – a kid my age. I don't know what my dad was thinking.
I've read The Deep as well.
Yeah. And there's the Marvel Comics adaptation of The Deep, unbelievable.
Oh, my God.
So Peter Benchley was really burning on all – they were – every water-related story they were buying, Hollywood was buying. He must have had a really good 70s. So this actress here playing the oceanographer is Colin Paxton. It's a – Colin, I guess it's a – that seems like a male name, but it's obviously an actress. Her most famous credit is she is the young girl in To Kill a Mockingbird who accuses Tom of attacking her.
No
she's,
kidding.
She's LMA. She's the one who's like, he attacked me and asked him to bust up my shiver robe. That's her. This is her. That was her number one credit. And she went on to do a lot more TV. She passed away in 2009. But yeah, that's her right here.
No way.
Yeah.
She's basically because they couldn't get Matt Hooper back into this movie. They needed somebody. And I love as they're examining the whale, and Brody's like, "Yeah, but what about the bite radius?" What
about He's learned.
We're all like really curious about the bite radius, because we know as the audience that that's important.
What's this bite radius crap, Dan?
Yeah. Come on. Oh, and of course she drops Carcharodon and Carcharias into the
cup. Yep.
To show she's an oceanographer.
She seems kind of impressed that he knows this stuff. She kind of looked at him like, oh, okay, wow, like that. She's like,
Yeah, kind of, but also in no hurry to find out what he's asking about.
No.
Just like, we'll get to it.
Yep. Oh, here we go. Yep. Big prop here.
This whale prop, I don't love it.
Okay.
Like so one of the things I wanted to talk about watching this movie is that this movie cost three times more to make than the original Jaws.
Right.
And like, I don't know where the money is, because it doesn't really appear on the screen for me.
Hmm.
Like this whale prop, again, I don't love it. I mean, it looks like a whale prop. certain shots, I think it looks okay, I guess. But like the lighthouse was like they had to build that thing, and I don't think it looks great. The island at the end where the climax of the film happens, like that was just kind of a raft.
Yeah, like a fiberglass
raft. Yeah. Like power island. This movie could look better overall, but just production value. This doesn't even look like the same beach, and it's not because they shot this in Florida instead of Massachusetts. There are moments in this film where I'm like, why didn't they spend the money to make this look a little better or whatever? But it certainly doesn't look like it costs three times more to make.
No, and it's kind of amazing to think when you know the legendary stories about how difficult Jaws was to get. I mean, they were shooting like a quarter page a day because they had so many technical problems. So you could see why that film might have cost a lot of money to make, because there were just a lot of unforeseen circumstances. But here, this seems like a relatively smooth – I mean, I guess starting over with John D. Hancock, with Janos Schwartz, that probably cost a little chunk of change.
Yeah, maybe.
Apparently there's – here's kind of the most Spielbergian shot in this movie of – Brody just looking out into the water, which is mirroring a little bit of the one shot in the first film where they just sort of pan out over the water. But apparently there are a couple of shots by John D. Hancock in this film, but most of that footage was just scrapped and it's never been seen. So again, release the Hancock cut. I mean, I'd love to see what that might have looked like.
Sure. There are some deleted scenes, and they're on the DVD if you ever get a chance to watch them. Some that I think actually do might make this a better film. And one of those is a scene with Mary Hamilton, which, you know, we haven't gotten to this scene yet, but there's a scene later on where Brody has the developed photograph that they found in that camera to prove that there's a shark. So he brings it to the selectman meeting, and they all basically make him sit down and wait while they go into another room to decide his fate, you know, and what they're
going
to do. And the scene that was cut, they take a vote on whether or not they want to let Brody keep his job or not. And Mayor Vaughn is the only dissenting vote, you know? And I think that might've been a good scene just for Mayor Vaughn. To see him stick up for Brody against everybody else. But since that scene's not in the film, he's just kind of he falls back into that same role. Like he hasn't learned anything. So it might have, even if it lengthened the movie just a little bit, it would have done a little more for Mayor Vaughn. But yeah, so I'm sure there's all these other scenes that exist that may make the film better, but they get cut.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame because, I mean, I would have liked to have seen what this alternate Jaws 2 version. I mean, you mentioned the novelization is based on the screenplay. The comic book adaptation is based on the screenplay. If you've never read the comic book, anybody, go take a look. I did a review of it for 13th Dimension, my real retro cinema column. It's drawn by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer, one of the great comic book teams of all time. And Gene Colan just lets it rip because the shark in that comic book is like the size of a battleship. I mean, it's just absurd. There's one point where it flies out of the water and attacks a boat, and it looks like it's the size of a battleship. And it's so much fun because they're just bringing all that Marvel energy to it. So it's a very, very fun adaptation. You can never pick that up. I don't know if it's on Comixology, but if you can ever pick it up for cheap, get the back issue of that magazine because it's a lot of fun. And then again, that shows you like how much the merchandising was built in. Marvel knew there is no comic book adaptation of Jaws because Nobody knew it was going to be that. But Jaws 2, they were ready. I think I was talking about there was the game, there was trading cards, there was cups, blankets, a coloring book. I want to know what the Jaws coloring book looks like. Because again, this is like, I mean, if you're making a coloring book, that's ostensibly for small children. And this movie is not for small children. At all. I mean, I may have seen it at 7, but this is not a movie for small children.
Yeah, I think PG meant something very different.
Yeah, it sure did. Here's probably the biggest gore scene of the movie coming up.
Yes.
Is Brody about to head out into the water here. This is definitely the most horror movie kind of thing.
Yeah, it in a way, I think it stands out in a bad way. I don't know that it tonally it's in keeping with the rest of the film. It feels like something out of like Creepshow.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, a Jaws movie. But yeah, you're right. This is definitely the most obvious like horror moment. Yeah,
I mean, you know, how can Brody not see this body? I mean, where does this body come from? I mean, yeah, I know Spielberg had Ben Gardner's head pop up through the hole, but at least, I don't know. It seemed a little more subtle than this.
I'm sure that is exactly what they were thinking about when they shot the scene or put this sequence in the film. Because, you know, there's...
Here it comes.
Yeah, there it is.
Whoa! Oh, and it practically jumps on him like the skull, like the skeletons do Marion in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes. But there's so many of these, like, analog moments, right, that your parallel moments, that, you know, harken back to that original film, and it just underlines how much they were relying on the success of that first movie.
Yeah.
Even down to Brody having like a one-liner before killing the shark, and
yep.
I hate that line because it feels so tacked on. Like, have him say something clever. So this moment might be one of my favorite of the pulpier moments in the movie, where Brody is lacing his bullets with cyanide. I think it is, right, or it's
something. Yep. It says sodium cyanide on the bottom, cyanide.
And then, you know, melting the wax like. No one in real life does this.
This is like John Wick kind of stuff.
Yeah, this is...
No pun intended.
Yeah, this is some like Death Wish type stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I could totally see Charles Bronson leaning over a desk, filling his ammunition with cyanide.
I'm going to put cyanide on my bullets. Okay.
But, in a couple scenes, he's going to fire a gun into the ocean, like, and cause a panic on the beach. And the Brody in the book is he's really just focused on solving, or not solving, but prosecuting this criminal. And he's solving the deaths of the water skier. And he's trying to figure out what was going on with the two divers in the camera. Like he seems to think that these cases might be connected. You know, he's so focused on that he doesn't really have time to think about the fact that there might be a shark out in the water. So I said to you the other day, like, I got through like 200 pages of this 240 page novel, and it wasn't until like 200 pages in that Brody was like, oh shit, there's a shark out there. the book, I mean, it's not a great book. The movie at least has some action in it, and you know, I think the paranoid Brody keeps the story going, but the book has its own pros as well. I won't delve into those because I think people should read it.
Right. Oh, here's the phone call from Matt Hooper.
Yes,
talks about she was just talking to Matt, and he's going to be out of phone range because he's going to be on the Aurora, like they mentioned. So there's our nod to Matt Hooper. So
how convenient, he won't be within range.
Yep. Getting mad at him. He's busy doing the Goodbye Girl or whatever it is out there. So he's busy.
The only thing this movie's missing is like a Quint tombstone or something.
Right.
Let's just bring everybody back.
The Quint Memorial Seafood Restaurant or something like that, run by his little toady that he had in that movie.
I mean, although we do get the Orca, so maybe that is
yeah, that's true. Okay.
How we get our Quint.
Bit. Yeah. By the way, who wrote the novelization? Who's the author on that book?
So it was written by Hank Searles.
Okay, I have no idea who that is.
Played by Howard Sackler and Dorothy Tristan, inspired by Peter Benchley's Jaws.
Okay, so Dorothy Tristan is John D. Hancock's wife, and that's who wrote the screenplay, and she also got fired along with Hancock, so that's interesting. So she does get credit, at least, for the sort of some of the bare-bones material in the story.
Well, she does and she doesn't. The film only credits... Carl Gottlieb and Howard.
Right.
Spencer. Dorothy Tristan gets none of the credit.
But she's on the book at least, though.
She's on the book, yeah. Because, like I said, supposed earlier, I thought the novel may have been based on the original screen.
Right, right.
You know. Here's everybody. Amen to fix it.
Teenagers frolicking here.
I actually really enjoy what they're doing with the kids in this movie. I know that they became major characters. To beef up the script a little bit and to take some of the pressure off of Brody, so he's not in every frame of this movie. and I kind of like what they're doing in terms of giving it that sort of 1950s vibe of kids like hanging out with their cars and cruising and all that, except they move it to the ocean. So that all these kids have these catamarans or sloops, and they're just out there hanging out. And, you know, because otherwise it kind of works like one of those 1950s like car movies in some respects. These kids, like all the characters, again, from the novel, they were part of Mike's diving class.
Right.
Part of the book involves him really begging to get involved in this diving class. He wants to get his certification and all that. So all these kids are members of the diving class. And, I guess they were that was changed from the original script. So now they're, you know, teenagers. But all the names were pretty much kept the same. That was interesting.
I like that better because it gives them a little more reason to be all involved together as opposed to just being a bunch of kids that are hanging out together.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, some of the things I think work better in the book, some work better in the movie, but I do like what the movie does in terms of like, you know, giving them that, I don't know, that whole thing of hanging out in the boats. Except the characters aren't really well developed. That's my criticism. You know, they all kind of, I forget who's who.
Yeah, the names of the teenagers are sort of indistinct. But it's funny, we got Mayor Vaughn here and Peterson together. They've got a whole real, it's kind of like Admiral Hux and Adam Driver in The Force Awakens. Like, you've got a bad guy and then, like, the sub-bad guy.
Oh, yeah,
you
gotta get that.
Kylo Ren. I was blanking on Kylo Ren for some reason. I don't believe they didn't give him his anchor jacket back. I mean, come on.
Yeah, he does. He's not as snappy of a dresser.
He just dresses like a normal 70s guy here. He doesn't have that anchor jacket. There's Brody's lonely crusade there is in that tower. Watching out for the sharks. Okay, all right. I will say, watching this, I mean, I have watched this movie now three times. This is my third pass in the last week, and maybe this film isn't meant for that kind of viewing. But I will say, I do feel like it's like, wow, we are not even at the halfway mark. I'm like, this film's kind of dragging a little bit. Like, all right, come on.
Yeah, and ultimately, like, the scenes I was talking about that got cut, you know, that's why they got cut, because this movie is already 2 hours long.
It does not need to be 2 hours.
This film doesn't.
This film does not need to be the same length as the original Jaws. That's crazy. But, yeah, all right. Oh, Mike's feeling left out, all the kids. Well, he's stuck painting. Yeah. There's one actress there, the one we just saw. That is, her name is Donna Wilkes. She did a lot of TV. She was in a movie recently, a couple years ago, called 90210 Shark Attack.
So of course.
Whatever the hell that is. And she was she's the title character in the 1984 B-movie Angel, which featured the classic tagline, honor student by day, hooker by night. And that was a film that played on cable a lot when I was a kid. And I remembered, this is a tangent, but that film, that poster was the riff Jay Leno had back when Jay Leno was just a comedian, because he used to talk about, and then it says something about that film that people knew the tagline, even though it was not a major film. But the tagline was honor student by day, hooker by night. And his take was, well, then what's the problem? You know, I mean, she's keeping up her grades, so what's the difference? But so she's Angel, and even though she's very sweet faced here, she plays a sort of hard bitten prostitute in Angel.
I mean, who can't relate to that, Rob?
Exactly. There's Brody there. Oh yeah, I can only imagine for Roy Scheider what a lonely shoot this must have been. I mean, I didn't get the sense that him and Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss necessarily became super buddies on the first film, but it just, I don't know. I would have to imagine it had to feel, you have to feel kind of lost out here without your two compatriots, especially when the second half of the first film is just the three of them. And now he's got to sort of like carry the whole movie by himself.
Important the ensemble was in the first Jaws. When the movie is really just left to Brody and it all has to sit on his shoulders, I don't know that he's a strong enough character to really, do it all himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that could be why they brought so many of the original cast back, just to have these kids be such a prominent feature of the film, just to again take some of the weight off of him. But still, he's the one main character we care about.
Yeah.
Today, and this is a movie that I think he can handle.
Like, he's just waving a gun around.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks a little crazy right now. He really does. He's running around. Good, he's waving his revolver. Good Lord, that's scary. You're just trying to have your, Amity means friendship. Brody, don't you know that? What are you talking about? Look at him. Oh, look at that. Oh, boy. Oh, shoot. Oh, now he's just firing randomly to the water. Oh, Lord. Oh, no.
It's sad that all of his cyanide bullets just got wasted.
Yeah, all that time he took.
That scene, that setup doesn't amount to anything.
Nope. Oh, they're all like, what did you just do?
Firing it into some bluefish.
What? Oh, man. Ah, that sucks for Brody.
Dude, he looks so worn out in this movie.
He does.
Better. Like...
They hint a little bit here that Peterson... has got, well, make more than hint, actually. Peter, like, here, look, he's getting a little handsy with Ellen there. I know that was a storyline in the book, of the original book, is that Hooper has an affair with Mrs. Brody, and luckily they took all of that out for the movie. But here, you get the sense Peterson is trying to maybe, get in on Chief Brody's action there. He really likes Ellen. And of course, the Ellen and Chief Brody. Look at that! Look, get your hand off her. What are you doing, buddy?
So I don't know. I don't know if that's as much him having some kind of interest in her or just classic '70s chauvinism.
Could be.
I think it's just at the time maybe guys felt they had a right to do that.
Put their hand around a woman. Yeah. But there is that scene earlier, though, where he talks to Brody about how important Ellen is to him, where he talks about how vital she is to help him out. So I always get the sense that he's just trying. He's trying. Maybe he's not. Oh, this is sweet. The son, the younger son, is always with Brody.
Yeah,
just sweet. But
it's hard to know how much of Peterson is intentional. Because I can say there's none of that in the book, although. There is a subplot where Ellen is kind of jealous of the time Brody is spending with a girl who works down forensics.
Oh, wow. Okay. Amity Man of the Year. I like that award, the Amity Man of the Year. Who won the previous awards? Previous
right.
Years there?
How the Mighty Have Fallen. But yeah, so Ellen's suspicions are based on nothing more than that. This woman called the house for Chief Brody.
Okay.
And she's like, who's this woman calling you? And he's like, it's the woman who's doing like a ballistics test for me. Relax. it's some strange way. They tried to reverse the affair angle in a very light way. And it's silly.
Is the woman oceanographer in the book, the novel?
No, the whole with the orca is not in there.
Okay. Cause that could have, that I see you could have worked that angle, that he's spending a lot of time talking to the woman oceanographer, and that could make Ellen jealous. That seems like to lend itself naturally. Oh, now he's gonna go get the photos developed. Okay, and they're gonna take a look at this.
And
now,
go ahead.
We're gonna come up on this scene here, and there's a moment here where I feel like this is quintessential—no pun intended—quintessential. That this film does not trust its audience the way Spielberg did. And we'll get to it in a moment. Just where I feel like they really lather something on when they didn't need to. But I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
an interesting difference here is that the man. So there's a character in the book who works at the pharmacy, and that's where photos get developed in Amity. And when he sees the evidence of a shark in the photos, he decides that Brody lied about the shark being dead. The shark is still out there, and he's going to sell his pharmacy. Like, he's going to keep the photos to himself, sell the pharmacy, and get the hell out of town before anybody knows what's up.
Oh, wow.
So the photos really don't even come into play until much later, like almost the end of the movie, after the shark is already attacking the boats, like the kids on the boats. But I kind of like how the photos are used here instead.
See, now I like this sequence. I really do. The cutting back and forth, getting closer and closer. I like how he looks. I mean, he's looking at the eye. This is great. I think this is very effective. But then I think they ruin it by Brody talking, where he has the line. He says, "There, that's it. That's the one. You don't need that line."
Yeah.
He doesn't need to say that. We know it's the one. Like, you can just read it all on, oh, look, there's there's the hotel lady. I don't think it's funny at all. But, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, that scene is really, I think, quite effective. And it would have been just fine with just a close-up of Roy Scheider. You didn't need him to say, that's it, that's the one. It's like, well, we know. You didn't need to underline it like that. And that's, I feel like Spielberg wouldn't have not done that. He just would have held on Scheider's face, and that would have been enough.
Right. Or you know, and let the music do the work. But, yeah. I mean, that's another thing is that John Williams composed this score before the movie was done. So, you know, there was no way they could build that sequence around, you know, a piece before. But.
Now here he's – Scheider, I dug the way he plays this because, I mean, we know he's right. But right. He does not – acquit himself well. He does act a little crazy here,
right?
And so if you are skeptical of Chief Brody, he's not going to help. He's not making his case very well. He really is acting a bit like a raving.
Sure. I think if he hadn't fired a gun on the beach a couple scenes ago, then I could then it would seem strange to me that the rest of the people on this committee would not take his side. You know what I mean? He was man of the year. And he was right about the shark. He took care of the shark problem a few years ago. They should be on his side. But because he's been kind of a raving maniac, you know, even if there is a shark out there, is this the guy they want?
He has the line. Brody has the line about, I'm sure as hell not going to go through it again. Now, he's referring to this time. But obviously, I think in some level, that's Roy Scheider talking about, I'm not doing any more of these goddamn Jaws movies. That's it. Because I think there's even a quote from him about, you know, somebody asked him, were you even approached for Jaws 3? And he said, they knew enough not to even bother to ask me.
It's, isn't it Jaws 4 where we just get a shot of a photo of him?
Yeah.
In Brody's house.
And it's funny because that's just like his IMDb photo too. it's like, it's not even, they didn't even get like a candid photo from the movie. Like, it looks like it's a promotional photo. Oh, here we go. This shot's reversed. All the topography is backwards.
I didn't notice that.
I wonder why that is. Why they felt the need to look. The dartboard numbers are backwards. The writing on everybody's t-shirts are backwards. I wonder why. I guess if this was shot by Swark, he wanted the camera panning from right to left as opposed to left to right, and he realized he needed to flip it. But the first time I see that, and the kid is playing the pinball game, I'm like, wait, what is that lettering? What is that? That looks like Cyrillic or something. And I realize, oh, it's just flipped.
I never noticed that. That's a good catch.
Yeah. Now, here it said, the one actor on the left-hand side, the far left, is Gary Springer. He was in Dog Day Afternoon. He was in a film called Between the Lines, which is about a newspaper, which looks really interesting. I know him from one episode of MASH. He played a patient in an episode of MASH, and he has a long sort of extended scene with Harry Morgan playing Colonel Potter in a season 5 episode of MASH. So that's where I know him from. And say, here's everybody. Yeah, okay. They were big on caps back then. Everybody's got the – Keith Gordon's got the cap. The other kid's got the cap. They all have those – that was a weird fashion thing in the 70s.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, I wish this girl here, the one, you know, I forget her name.
I don't know. The actress is Donna Wilkes. I don't know the character name, but.
Her character name is, oh, God, I had it. I think is it Jackie? No, it's not Jackie. Whatever her name is.
Yeah, I can never remember any of these characters' names.
She's, it is Jackie.
Oh, it is Jackie. Okay, Jackie, yeah.
You know, she's Mike's love interest, right? Mm-hmm. I would have liked to have seen a little more of that play out. Just because, you know, I think if Mike's character had been more developed and that relationship had been a little more developed, then I think this movie would have felt a little more fleshed out. Mm-hmm. There's been enough time with those characters for us to really get to know them.
Oh, look, check out what's the barrel is a planter. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, I caught that too. I love that little detail. But yeah, I just wish that more time had spent on these other characters, just so, you know, because I think this movie it very much deals in shorthand. You know, you saw the first Jaws, so you know who Brody is, you know who Ellen Brody is, but we don't know this teenage Mike.
Yeah.
And we don't know what his deal is. We don't really know who this version of Sean is. I think that's where this movie really falls short.
They try and hint at a little bit of the idea that that Mike is, you know, having a tough time. He's a teenager, and he's dealing with the fact that his dad is the local town nut. They don't really get into that too much, but I think they're trying to hint at that. That, of course, every teenager wants to just kind of go through life anonymously. The last thing you want is to be known as, you know, your day. Oh, you're the son of that guy who's the raving Luke. Shut up the beach. And of course, on a tiny town like this, everyone knows who everybody is.
Yeah. It almost makes you wonder how the movie would have turned out if Mike was the main character.
And then, right. Apparently that was an idea, that it was going to be like Mike and some descendant of Quint.
Right.
I don't even understand that. I don't believe Quint. I can't wrap my head around Quint having a child.
Yeah, I don't necessarily buy that specifically, but like if we take this story as it exists and have Mike be the primary character and have Brody kind of exist in the periphery, you know, we can I think that would have been a better movie.
Brody drinks a lot.
Yeah, he does.
He drinks a lot.
Extra big drinks for himself, but only for himself.
Yep.
I've been meaning to try one of those, like, little bit of red wine, glass full of whiskey kind of. Or no, I'm sorry. No, it's a little bit of whiskey with a, you know, a big tall glass of red wine. Always wanted to do that just for the hell of it.
Just for the experience?
Yeah.
By the way, everybody, right now Dan is drinking out of a Jaws mug while we're doing this commentary.
Yes, I've got a ceramic. Similitude. I've got a ceramic Jaws mug, which I got from HotTopic.com, and I made a Cape Codder cocktail for this.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And you have the Jaws game, right? The recent game that just came out like last year?
Yes. I got it for my birthday last year, I believe.
Is it any good? Have you played it, or you haven't gotten around to it yet?
It's a lot of fun. It's a four-player game, and one person plays the shark, and they have a secret little pad where they keep track of their movements, and they swim around Amity eating swimmers. And everybody else, like the other three players, will play Quint and Hooper and Brody, and each has different abilities. And the object is to get two barrels on this shark before he eats too many swimmers. The more swimmers he eats, the more resources he has for the second half of the game, and vice versa.
That's fun.
And once you get two barrels on the shark, then you flip the board, and the board becomes the orca. And then the shark is choosing points of attack in the different sections of the orca. And as the shark does damage, pieces come away. Target's got it. I forget how much, but I think it's a Target exclusive.
It's fun. They actually put some thought behind that.
Yeah. I think much more thought than the original game from the 70s. Although I think that's a really fun, like, curio to have in my game collection.
Yeah. I played that game with my sister ad nauseum. We played it many, many times in our living room in our house in Philadelphia. So it was a fun game.
It looks nice on my shelf.
It's a nice piece. I mean, like the ceramic shark or whatever. And I think I probably mentioned this maybe during our Jaws audio commentary. But it is actually more related to Jaws 2, is that the Mego toy company just realized that they had a shark – with all the shark craze going on, they had a shark-related character sitting in their laps, namely Aquaman. And so they put out an Aquaman versus the Great White Shark playset. And it's the Aquaman doll, the standard Aquaman Mego doll, boxed with a plastic gray shark. And you bought it together. And the box has got this like a die-cut wave thing with a cellophane window. It's a very, very beautiful toy. And they figured Mego never missed a opportunity to cash in on a trend. And so that's what they put it out. But unfortunately, Aquaman was never one of their more popular figures. And the toy just died on the vine. It quickly became pulled off of shelves. And so nowadays, it's been re-released. But since, you know, in the intervening years, if you wanted to buy an original boxed Aquaman versus the Great White Shark playset, it would set you back thousands of dollars. It's an incredibly rare item at this point. But Mego figured, hey, sharks are popular. We got Aquaman. Why not?
Yeah, it makes sense that toy companies or, you know, anybody for that matter would try to add sharks to whatever it is they had, you know?
Yeah, why not? It's free. You don't have to pay anybody. There's no
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Power Records had a Jaws of the Shark record, which was four adventures of people going shark hunting. And it is dull as dishwater, the stories. They are boring. The only thing is worth looking at it all, and you can see this on my Power Records blog, and we actually talked about this on an episode of the Power Records podcast, Chris Franklin and I, is the sleeve is by Neil Adams. So, of course, the shark looks menacing as all get out. And the like I told you, the name of the record is Jaws of the Shark, and the word Jaws is in giant letters, and then it's like of the shark in tiny letters. Sure. Because, you know, they're trying to skirt the copyright thing here.
Yeah.
So, all right, we're now in the second part of the film, and we're, you know, the film doesn't really replicate the first film's bifurcated nature. You know, the first film it's a horror film from hour one, and then it's an adventure film from hour two. I mean, it's almost literally exactly at the hour-long mark when Brody and Hooper and Quint head out on the Orca. I mean, it almost seems purposeful. It's like, I think it's like at 1 hour and 1 second is the second half of the movie begins. This movie isn't quite that organized, but we are set headed out to, okay, Brody's going to have to come from behind, and all of our presumed victims are now out on sea here with their, on their catamarans and stuff.
Yeah. And here we can see where the diving class got worked back into this.
Yep. There you go.
And so these kids, not the divers, but, you know, Mike and his friends, they're just out there cruising, right? Like, they're hanging out on the water. One of the things I liked about the novel is that instead of just being them cruising around, having a good time, they're in a regatta.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Ellen Brody is, part of the committee that organized this regatta. And it's like a 2-hour race. And so it's like an actual legitimate race. And as they're involved in that, like a fog comes in and the shark's heading out there to eliminate any potential threats to its offspring. Cause it's like urge of giving birth. And so Mike and his friends are the only remaining threats to that. So I actually quite enjoy how that climax is orchestrated as opposed to this. Cause for the rest of the movie, it's like another hour of Mike and his friends on the water having a good time until the shark shows up.
Right.
And it moves very slowly. If it weren't for this shark attack sequence here, I don't think there would be much else. Right.
I guess. No, not really. All sharks do is swim and eat and make little sharks. That's all they do. There's a little can. Okay. my vegetarianism is coming out. Like, leave the poor thing alone. It wasn't bothering anybody. That lobster was just sitting there, minding his own business, and you tried to grab him, and it ran away. Of course it did. It's nice looking footage. You know what I mean? Like, it's a nice looking movie. Overall,
and that's true from my experience of other Peter Benchley adaptations. Like I said, I've read The Deep, and I saw the film version of that, and there's a lot of underwater footage.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just, you know, because Peter Benchley was such an avid diver.
Here we go. Oh,
yeah. I actually do really like that the shark has like a scarred
face. Battle damage.
I mean, if that doesn't have toy written all over it.
And isn't that amazing that they didn't make that? They apparently, you could buy a model of Brody's truck. What the hell are you supposed to do with that? Like, what, drive around the town? I mean, what am I supposed to play? Like, and do what? You know? But yeah, I love the battle damage shark. That's a fun detail that because it was set on fire, it's got all that scabby stuff on the side of its face. That's a nice...
It reminds me of... In the 90s, when Jurassic Park came out, and for years after that, there were Jurassic Park toys. I had a ton of them. And all of the dinosaurs had little breakaway pieces to expose, like, you know, as like battle damage, you know, you
right.
could break off a piece of their exterior and you could see like the flesh underneath. I thought that was really cool. It's a wonder they didn't make a shark like that when this
came. Why not just? I mean, that's what kids would want to do, is play with the shark.
That's right.
I mean, yeah, that didn't make any. Yeah, I don't know why. And it would be relatively cheap to produce, really.
Just
a shark, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Now the movie's just a lot of footage of sailing. A
lot of B-roll here. A lot of B-roll of people in there.
It makes me wonder what the second unit director got for all this.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie does not need to be an hour and 58 minutes. That's a little on the padded side. Brody's got nothing to do. He's just walking around smoking.
I love that that Ellen calls him out for all of his smoking in this.
Hmm.
She's like, "You're having another cigarette?" He's like, "It's coffee."
Yeah. See, that, I mean, this is a problem with the pacing, is that right when the movie really should start to pick up, it's kind of meandering.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, you know, our main character's got nothing to do. It's like, oh, that's kind of a weird dramatic choice for your horror movie at the hour and 5 minute mark or whatever we're at here. It seems like, you know, we're kind of like, all right, hour and 10. And then we're just watching the Brody's putts around the house. Like, okay.
This is sort of what I was talking about. You know, when I said I wish the movie had been more about Mike, because, you know, just as the movie could be about Mike, like this whole second half of this movie could really be about Mike. They feel the need to cut away from that to check in with Brody again. Why?
Yeah.
We don't. I mean, he's unemployed now. What's he doing?
This is what a lot of people are doing in America right now. During
I don't need to. Like, I watched this movie to escape, not to be reminded of what my life is like.
Wear your masks, everybody. Wear your masks. It's a shame that they couldn't. It would have been fun to have a phone call cameo from Richard Dreyfuss. I can see why they didn't, but it would have been fun. They could have done this maybe at some point in the film where he actually calls Hooper or whatever. But that
sure.
I could see Richard Dreyfuss probably didn't want to do it, you know, and wouldn't want to be bothered with this.
Yeah, of course. Like, you know what, and maybe this is what they were going for, and I don't think it's as effective, but, like, I think I would feel better about this sequence in particular, or these sequences of Brody, if they really did anything to advance the Brody and, or the Martin and Ellen Brody kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, in a way, it sort of reminds me of like Rocky II. You know, how much of Rocky II is kind of a retread of the first movie. But one of the things that I love a lot about Rocky II is the way it advances the Rocky and Adrian relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they become a more developed relationship, or, you know, couple. They have a child. You know, I think all that stuff is interesting and worth exploring. Here, they don't seem to do anything with the time they've got, you know? And as a result, I think it's definitely slows down in the second half.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that could have been a way to handle that material and not make it feel so dull.
All right, now we're going to go to two of our teen characters are going to start getting it on. This is very slasher film.
Yes.
That's an interesting observation that, yeah, this is kind of pre-slasher films as we've come to know them. But this is straight up slasher film. Of the two teens are going to go, they're going to get it on, presumably. And she's like, can you put down a blanket at least? And he's like, yeah, right. Look at it. He's just fighting for it. And then she's taking her hair down. She's like, oh, she's serious. And then now we're, you know, here's Michael Myers. Here's Jason. Here's whatever character you want is going to interrupt the fun here. Oh, look at that. Boom. There we go.
Oops.
Oh, right in the water. Okay. Now she gets pushed away. The shark is just pushing the boat way out. So he's now stranded. He's out in the middle. He's way away. She's okay.
It's I heard a little bit about this actor. When they shot this scene, he didn't know how to swim.
Oh, geez.
And he was kind of naturally afraid of being in the water.
No shit, yeah.
So they're like, we think it probably added to his performance in this scene. I'm like, you think?
Oh my god, what? Oh, that. Oh,
and then,
man.
And then, yeah, and then they talked about, you know, shooting this scene coming up. You know, they just kind of had to like tie a rope to him and literally just drag him through the water.
Oh my god! Oh wow! Jeez. Yeah. Oh, the shark is now going under the water. Oh man,
what's this? That would be
terrifying. That would to be.
I actually really like that shot of the shark.
The shark going under the boat there.
Under the boat. It reminds me of my favorite shot in the original Jaws of the guy in the pond. That sort of brief glimpse of the shark you get.
Yes, before he gets pulled down. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, fellas, you guys doing okay? Oh, here we go. He's going to get...
Yeah, he just got pulled with a rope.
There you go. Boom! Right into the side of the thing. He's going to take off a piece of the little breakaway boat, right? You can even see the little cut that they have on the boat. So when he grabs it, it'll just break off in his hand there. There you go, right there. Oh, and now the water's filled with Kool-Aid, so okay. He's gone. It's one less kid.
I mean, all things considered, I do think that's an effective scene. It just, but, you know, I can't get away from this whole slasher idea. I think it just exists to up the body count a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. They got to wonder, how hungry is this shark? I mean, we know from the novelization that the shark is pregnant, but still, I mean, you see the shark is probably 25, 30 feet, and it eats a whole person. You would think that, I don't know. I mean, sharks, as we again learned from the first film, sharks' digestion is very slow. So you would think that if it ate a whole person, it would be sated for a little while. But this shark just gobbles people like Pac-Man.
That's actually a good.
I mean, it's just, it's insatiable. I mean, the shark just keeps going and going and going. But although maybe the shark doesn't eat the whole person, you know, maybe he bites the arm off or bites the, you know, maybe the shark can't swallow the whole person necessarily. So maybe he's not getting everything here. So I aspire to live like Brody in that I want to be that tan when I'm his age. I just want to look leathery. I want to wear shorts all year round. That is what I want. There aren't a lot of movies where the hero wears shorts because I just think it's not. Oh, he's got bit right through the. That's a pretty effective, but a cheap little.
Yeah, I dig it.
Bit, you know, that you got so scared you bit through the mouth guard thing. That's pretty scary. And there's even little traces of blood on it, which is again, nice touch. But this is what I want. I want to live somewhere where I'm wearing shorts year round. That is my goal. I haven't been able to get there yet, but someday I want to. That's what I want.
We got to move up to Martha's Vineyard.
Well, that's going to get cold, though. You have to figure somewhere where it's warm all the time.
That's true. Well, this was shot in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right, right.
Florida, so you could that's an option for you.
I guess so. Maybe so.
I love it that Brody can't operate a boat.
I know. You would think he would have learned. I mean, come on, Brody. You don't know how to pilot a boat at this point. He's been on this island a couple of years now.
Yeah.
This is not his first summer, you know.
Not anymore. No, last summer.
Not anymore. Hendrix is showing a little bit of initiative. You know, he's doing a little bit of like, all right.
I really want to know what this movie would have been without Hendrix.
Yeah, I know. Like, I wonder what was the alternative here? What happened if there was no Hendrix?
Yeah.
I think we may have talked about this in the first audio commentary, but I've always wondered, you know, everyone knows now in Jaws lore that Brody's line about you're going to need a bigger boat was an ad-lib. That was Roy Scheider's ad-lib. Yep. And so what was the line? What was the original line? If the line we know is an ad-lib, what was in the script that they presumably shot and didn't use? I don't think I've ever learned that. I mean, I've never read any sort of Jaws screenplay that had the original line. So I would love to know, like, what did Carl Gottlieb have in there that Roy Scheider improved upon?
Now I'm curious.
Yeah, I don't know. There are these kids on the catamaran here. Just as an aside, this is a very white movie. I don't think I've seen a single person of color in this whole movie.
Well,
I mean, no, it's Martha's Vineyard, but still.
You gotta wait till Jaws 3.
Yeah.
And we get Louis Gossett Jr.
Now, these are the kind of teens that Quint would look down upon as counting money all their lives.
Oh, 100%.
You know, these are...
Day sailing.
You got city hands. Yeah, day sailing. Yeah. Oh, that guy right there, the guy that looks like Napoleon Dynamite. I should mention that actor's name is G. Thomas Dunlop. He has all of 2 credits, including Jaws 2. So, obviously, did not have much of a film career after this. Again, you would think that you'd be able to parlay being in a movie this successful into something, but I guess not. But again, maybe that's the fact that everyone knows that no one's seeing this movie for the kids. They're seeing it for the shark. And even Roy Scheider knew that. Even apparently there's a quote from him where he says something like that. He's like, look, I know that I'm incidental to this film. People are here to see the shark. Now they're going to come across the girl. Now this isn't – I like this detail that this girl is most likely scarred for life.
Oh, for sure.
That's a fun detail because like we get the sense at the end of the first film that Brody and Hooper shrug it off. Despite having one of the most terrifying experiences in what human brains could imagine.
Yeah.
Especially Brody. Well, no, both of them. I mean, Hooper got attacked by the shark in the cage. And then Brody watched Quint get eaten right in front of him. And I would think, how does that not haunt your dreams for the rest of your life? That's a good shot right there. I like that shot.
Yeah. Well, Hooper, I buy getting back in a boat and getting back on the water
because he's an oceanographer. He's
and also it wasn't his first time tangling with a shark. You know, if you remember, a baby thresher turned his inboard.
That's right, inboard to an outboard.
He ate his whole boat as a kid.
Whole boat. Yep.
So I buy that him as an oceanographer, knowing that this was an unusual circumstance with a shark, would get back into a boat. But Brody. Yeah, I got to figure he would have suffered some PTSD.
Yeah, so I like that this girl is – you get the sense this girl is screwed up permanently.
Yeah.
And she sells – look, this is good. She sells this. Like, she looks completely stricken. I really hate that Ellen is on this adventure. She just doesn't belong. It just this is just not plausible that this character – and I don't mean that it's because it's a woman. I mean because it's Ellen. I just don't buy that Ellen Brody would go out on the boat and do this. This seems just not plausible behavior on her part. But, you know, again, Sue Sheinberg insisted that she be in on this adventure. So, okay. And, I mean, all credit to Sue Sheinberg. Sue Sheinberg gave Steven Spielberg his break. So, I mean, it wasn't like Stu Scheinberg was some sort of horrible executive who didn't know what he was doing. He was actually a pretty good executive, and he knew talent when he saw it. But he seems like he got maybe a little too involved in the in this film.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I love Lorraine Gary in the original Jaws, but I think if the sequels have taught me anything, it wasn't a very strong actor.
Yeah.
I don't know, why she's the star of Jaws 4.
Yeah, they had nobody left, you know? I think they literally had nobody left. There's no other characters to... Oh, this is Keith Gordon doing the speech. Oy, 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 that is... This does make you want to kind of see this kid get eaten. You're like, oh, just stop. Just stop being... Okay, all right. Ah, we're all having a good time. No way this is going to go bad.
Yeah, I love Keith Gordon as this nerd who just...
Oh, look at that! Yeah, I mean, yeah, Swark is not hiding the shark now. I mean, we are getting big, giant close-ups of the fiberglass shark. It looks pretty good. I mean, it looks real, you know? It looks...
Well, I don't know.
I mean, as real as I know. I mean, for God's sake, I've never been that close, so...
The same husband and wife team provided, you know, real-life footage of...
Oh, okay. The Taylors, I believe. Ron and Valerie Taylor, I believe.
Yeah, those are real sharks in there. But, like, when the shark jettisons out of the water, like, I don't necessarily... Go. Oh, man.
He's just cutting through these teens like a hot knife through butter now. He's just right. Knocking them all. He's got his little sailing gloves. Some of these characters I don't even know at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, like I said before, I think that's one of to the detriment of this film.
That one, that girl there? Who is that? Like, I don't even know. The one. Okay. Now we're just, we're just dunking people left and right here into the water.
Larry Vaughn Jr. is one of these kids.
That's right. They call him Junior Vaughn or something. They've like a shorthand for him or something.
But, like, that could have been a great movie. Like, Mike Brody and Larry Jr. Yeah, there's still, like, a half hour left in this movie.
Yeah, it's a little much. It's sort of funny how non-purient this movie is. I mean, you really could have... The girls are not on display. I mean, like, you could have reasonably had girls in bikinis in this sequence, and they don't do it. The girls are dressed pretty, you know, pretty daintily, not daintily, pretty kind of drably. And if they really had wanted to add a little bit of sex to the movie, they could have. They could have had all the girls. They could have really had like Playboy models practically in these bikinis, but they didn't. They didn't do that.
Yeah,
they would. I mean, I guess those are the Piranha movies. I guess that's the idea there. Yeah, this is good. Oh, come on. All right. Get him up. There we go. He's coming. Pull him up. Hurry up. Look at that's great. I thought that looked great. I think that the way the shark's mouth moved, like it was I like that. That's a good. I mean, I guess you could see that, boy, you could just slip a whole body down in there and the shark probably wouldn't even notice. That's how big its gullet is.
Yeah.
There we go. That's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I do like that one shot of the shark as it skims the side of the boat.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. That's a pretty
fun one. Yeah.
It reminds me almost of the Jaws ride.
Have you ever taken that? Have you ever been down there? I've never taken that. I've never been on that.
Oh, man. That makes me sad because it's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when I was a kid, my family went down to Florida and we did Universal Studios, and I remember I don't remember if I had seen the movie yet or not, but my mom took me into the line for the Jaws ride, and like I remember just as we were about, like, we waited in the line for I don't know how long, and then it's finally our turn and I like chickened out. I was like
crying. Oh.
I was like, I don't want to get on this ride. I don't want to get on it. And my mom forced me onto the Jaws ride.
It's wow.
Like, she's like, we waited all this time to get on this ride. So we got on it, and you know, it was a scary ride for a kid. And then I forget how many times I'd been down to Universal, but I remember also going when I was a senior in high school. We took our class trip down to Florida, and we had passes for the Disney parks, for Universal. And I remember getting to do Jaws as an adult as well. And I remember having a really good time on that, just as a fan of the movie at that point. And so the Jaws run in Florida, it was great. And then in college, I went down out to California to Universal Studios Hollywood, and they worked in like a Jaws section of the studio tour, which
that's
is
cool.
A lot of fun. I think that's still part of it because it's part of the studio tour, not just a Jaws ride.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think if you go out to Hollywood, you can still experience a little bit of Jaws.
That's amazing to think about too, that, you know, there has not been a Jaws movie in 30 years and yeah. Yet it's still brand wise. It's still enough out there that yeah. you can do that. That's a real testament. And, you know, much like the Indiana Jones movies, supposedly there's going to be this fifth one, which I feel like they probably shouldn't even do at this point. But if they ever decided to make Jaws 5 and they were like, it's a, you know, sidequel or a rebootquel of these other, I would absolutely go see it. If you called it Jaws, I'd go.
Yeah. You know, I love Jaws so much that every time there's like a new shark movie out, I get excited because
yeah.
I just want to see another good shark movie.
Yep. Yep.
And I hate to be that guy, but I don't think there's really been a good shark movie since Jaws. At least not one that I found scary. There's been a couple that I think are fun. I think Deep Blue Sea is a lot of fun in a very hokey sort of way. But like, there's never been anything that I would consider like a masterpiece shark movie.
I really liked Open Water, but Open Water is not even so much about sharks. It's really more about people being stranded in the ocean.
Yeah.
And it's shot like a Blair Witch. It's basically Blair Witch with sharks. That was the sales pitch. And it's not really a shark movie per se, because it really could be anything. I have not seen The Shallows. I've heard that was okay. And I haven't seen 47 Meters Down, which supposedly is like, you know, kind of a passable B movie.
Sure.
But I have not seen either one of those. So we're getting to a big set piece coming up here.
I went to see The Shallows and I was unimpressed with it, but I know.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
This whole thing, by the way, we didn't talk about it when we got to it way early in the film, but we see when Hendrix and that pilot are dragging the ocean looking for the body, they find the electrical wire.
Yes.
They find the electrical cord. So we've layered that in now that, of course, Amity gets its power from these very, very thick, strongly preserved wires that lay literally across the length of the ocean. So we've layered that in now. We know that that's a thing. That's how Amity gets its power. I don't know anything about this. I'm like, what are those tubes that are so powerful that they can withstand salt water for decades on end? I mean, I don't know what that's, geez, I don't know what, I don't know what that material could be that could withstand salt water, but also be punctured by a shark's tooth.
Right.
That's really possible.
Well, clearly, Rob, you underestimate the power of this great white shark.
That's true. So here we go. Here's the big set piece of this movie. And I distinctly remember seeing this as a child and just being utterly terrified that the shark was this strong that it could basically drag a helicopter under the water. That was pretty scary. It's coming up. Here's this guy. He's like, okay, we're going to. I mean, it's not a full helicopter, but still, it's got those pontoons. So, I mean, you know, you really can't drag that thing under the water unless you are massively strong, which, of course, this shark is. So this guy's about to get it.
I do love this detail, just for the sheer, just because of how, like, over the top it is.
Which detail?
When I tell people at Jaws 2, it's like, oh, the shark eats a helicopter. You know? This thing's awesome. Yeah, tonally, this is way not in keeping with its predecessor, but there's some stuff like that if it was in another movie, if someone told me, oh, yeah, shark eats a helicopter in this, it's almost like describing the movie Zombie. Zombie fights a shark.
Zombie fights a shark, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so automatically...
Oh, there it is. Oh, that is one angry shark. Because now that shark's not even eating anybody. He's just...
Yeah.
He's just mad at everything. He's just mad. And some people just want to see the world burn. That's all that this shark is about.
That's it.
And now the chopper blades are going to go flying. That's... Ooh. That's pretty rough.
And supposedly that's accurate.
The blades would, yes, break off like that?
Carl Gottlieb was talking about this particular scene. I watched an interview with him, and he had worked on MASH.
Of course, yes, he's in the movie MASH, yes.
Yeah, and he had said that there was a scene where, like, he saw a helicopter kind of, like, lose control and fly off into the jungle, and, like, just the debris, like, the shrapnel, or not, would it be shrapnel? Just the blades, just, like... breaking off and flying off into the air, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Kind of how it might actually happen.
That's terrible. That's genuinely terrifying.
So there's some truth to it, even if a shark could not pull a helicopter into the ocean.
See, now, like, again, we're the film still has, I know we're kind of going over this, but the film still has 24 minutes to go. That's too much. It's just too much, you know. We've arrived at the film's kind of big set piece, which is the helicopter, and it that really needs to be like the last 10 minutes of the movie, not the last half hour of the movie. There's just just too much of this.
Or
move the helicopter scene later on to the further.
Or obviously move it forward and put it earlier in the movie.
I see what you're saying. Either move it up or move it back, but yeah.
It could have worked earlier in the movie, like, to establish the threat of
there we go. There. Oh, crunch. I love that kill. I love it. Again, that kid and this girl here, but that little boy is scarred for life. He just, here we go. No, speaking of scarred for life, she's done. She's done. She's, yeah, that's it. Goodbye. Exits the movie. She is going to be in therapy the rest of her life.
I love how efficient that shot is because the shark covers the body. So you can just buy that it eats that kid.
Yeah.
Just cut to reaction shots.
Yep.
All in one shot, you establish the shark coming up, eating the kid. Boom, done.
Just think how terrifying that would be to see a human get swallowed up by a shark. Oh, my God. Oh.
I think I mentioned it the last year when we did the Jaws commentary that, you know, to this day, I am very uncomfortable in the ocean.
Okay.
Like just because of that movie. I saw it when I was young, and as much as I love that movie, I get in the ocean, and I'm not comfortable.
Oh, I wasn't. When I would go floating around, but I would go in the water in the lake when we were on our vacation house, Lake Wallenpaupack. That's a lake. And my father had to explain to me a great many times, there are no sharks in lakes. And I was like, well... You know, well, okay, Dad. You know, all right.
I was always able to separate ocean and lakes and ponds and stuff. So, like, if I was in a lake, I felt okay. Although seaweed touching my foot was always
I didn't like that either. Yep,
freaking out. But it was specifically the ocean. I knew that I didn't have to worry about a shark in a lake. And again, to this day, still under the. I'm okay on a boat.
So you would not go see Jaws, as shown by the Alamo Draft House, floating in a inner tube on the ocean?
You know, so I think that that my logic holds, you know, that's in a lake.
Okay.
Or like a man-made pond or a lake or some sort. So I feel like it would be okay, but I know that they have like frogmen under the ocean or under the water to like freak people out during.
Oh, yeah. See, I wouldn't want that. That's too much.
I would, like, if I was in a swimming pool, hell yeah, I'd be in a tube.
I would do it in a swimming pool, absolutely, yeah. But not a natural body of water, because I'm just like, you know, who the hell knows what's in there?
I actually am organizing an outdoor screening of Jaws at my house this year.
Very nice. I know you've got a projector now, so you can do that.
Yes. Got the family coming over, and I'm going to get a case of Narragansett. And, yeah, it's going to be a good time.
All right, now they've got little Sean. All right, they got him back on the boat, and all right, everybody, oh, God, come on. See, this is the other thing, too. It's like, come on, guys, hold it together. Come on. For the love of Christ, you know.
Here's where I think Mike could have really taken charge, because he's a kid who, like, loves being on the water. He's really knowledgeable about sailing, like, and the movie doesn't do him any favors.
No, he's just another one of the characters. He's not.
He's another casualty when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah. Hey, there's that giant plexiglass island that they built. There it is. They're headed out to that. Apparently that, according to the IMDb trivia, at one point that whole prop got loose and started floating out to Cuba, and they had to go retrieve it back.
Yeah.
Movies are funny how they're made.
Everything I've heard about this production, it's that it was, like, as chaotic, if not a little more so.
Oh, Lord.
First.
Now, see this part, with all the teens just screaming at each other, like, that's just, come on, you know? You don't want them squabbling. Like, it's just noisy at that point. Like, everybody, shut up. Stop fighting. You're all in it together. Come on.
Yeah, there's a little more dick measuring than I'm comfortable with.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the, like this girl here, she really is barely. You don't even know who that is at all. You've been given no. She's been given no character beats at all. At least the other girl, Jackie, has, you know, we saw her on land talking to Mike, and stuff like that, and she's doing the whole quivering lip thing. But some of these other characters are literally just, they're just there to be shark chum, essentially. So.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Here's Brody finally. Very overcast, which is another thing. I mean, that's one of the things I love about the original movies, that they have such bright – well, that looks nicer there. It must have been a different day. But I like the bright, clear blue skies of the second half of Jaws.
Yes.
It looks like a men's adventure pulp novel cover come to life. And here, obviously, these are all shot on different days, presumably. But some of these – like this here, like look how overcast it is. Like it's kind of gloomy looking.
I would almost prefer if it was stormy instead of overcast.
Right, yeah, now it's a lot sunnier here. Here we go, here are the kids. All right, we're going to rescue these guys. Oh, Mike. Oh, Mike.
Yeah, I like don't even know who that kid on the right is.
No, me neither. Oh, now, like, what do you mean Sean's out there? What? Oh, my kids are – the kids are such a disappointment. Oh, for God's sakes.
Yeah, this is what I like about how in the book this scene involves a regatta. So, like, they're there with intent. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike is there sailing with this girl he's really into, and Sean is on a boat with another kid. So, like, they have a reason to be out there aside from just screwing around in the water. Here, it's just, yeah, they spend way too much time drifting, kind of killing time before the climax.
And it also doesn't really build. I know we're not breaking any new ground saying it's not as good as the first film. But, you know, if you're going to call your movie Jaws 2... guess what? You're going to be compared to the first Jaws. And by the way, I should mention, this is the first Hollywood film to use the numerical 2 in its title. To this point, all sequels were Roman numerals. This is the first time that they used Jaws 2. Now, there was a British sci-fi horror movie called Quatermass 2 from 1957, but that was made in England. This is the first Hollywood movie ever to do it. But, I mean, yeah, it like in the first film... each successive level of where they think will defeat the shark fails. So they keep going upwards. It's like, okay, Quint thinks he's just going to bring it down with barrels. No, that's not going to work. Well, now he's going to shoot it. Eh, that doesn't work. Yeah. Now, Hooper's going to try with his cage and his knockout poison. That doesn't work. And it's, you know, it just keeps escalating. Like this problem is getting bigger and bigger. This isn't really, this doesn't escalate. Like it's just kind of, okay, the shark now does this and now it does this. And here, now the kids are going to scream at each other again. Like this whole part. Oh God. You're like, oh, come on. Yeah, this is, you know, at this late in the film, you shouldn't be here. Finally, hey, I have something to contribute. How about me too?
Yeah, having that helicopter sequence happen when it happened, like it really underlines how much they didn't have, like they didn't have material to fill this time.
Yeah,
and I think the movie really depends on our on us caring about Sean.
Yeah,
and he's not just not that well developed of a character.
No, no. They could have made this the playset. They could have.
Oh my God! Can you imagine
the electrical island playset or something, and the little figures?
Considering the toys that were made in the 70s, I'm surprised that there wasn't like an electric island playset kind.
Mm-hmm. With the little power line, and you can get the shark, and he bites into it, and it glows. And he glows like his little eyes can glow or something. Yeah. That would be cool. Here we go. So okay.
I still can't get over Keith Gordon just in this movie.
He's really had quite... Oh, there he is. Now, look, this is the first time Brody is seeing the shark. He's not seen the shark up until this point. That's their first encounter.
That's true.
With only 10 minutes left of the movie. Brody's like, oh, wow, I was right the whole time. This really is the shark. But yeah, Keith Gordon's had quite... Oh, here we go. He's going to crash the boat. Keith Gordon's had quite a good career as an actor. And then later on as a director. Of course, he was in Christine and Back to School, but then he went on to direct Mother Night, the Kurt Vonnegut adaptation, and he did a Midnight Clear, the World War One war film. Yeah, he's really had quite a career. Good for him. Oh, we got a rescue raft. Okay, perfect.
In case you were wondering what was in there.
Yeah. Apparently, Scheider made a pretty penny off of this. Not only was his salary... I think they said five times what he got than from the first one.
But he
also had points off the back end.
Right.
And this thing was a monster, no pun intended, hit. So, I mean, you know, at least if you're going to do this, at least get rich off of it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Caine had the same logic when he did.
That's right. Jaws of Revenge.
He never saw the movie, but by all accounts...
The house that it bought me is beautiful.
He had seen the house that it paid for.
Yeah.
Like yeah. And then Robert Shaw did live to see this movie.
Yes, he did.
And he was very happy to not be a part of such a huge piece of shit.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the quote. Thank God
I wasn't involved in
this piece of shit. Yeah. Now with, unfortunately, now with Roy Scheider gone, it's sort of up to Richard Dreyfuss to kind of, you know, be the standard bearer. And of course, he had a cameo in the Piranha movie.
Yes.
Playing unofficially Matt Hooper.
Right.
In that scene. So, all right. Oh, we've caught the electrical wire. That's interesting.
Where have we seen that before?
Oh, look at that. Peekaboo. It's like Johnny Carson coming out from behind. Look at this shark's just now. People are just falling. Whoa! People are comically falling into the water.
Yeah,
you know they're like yeah.
I like that zoom in on Jackie. As yeah, such a very 80s horror film.
All right, at least we can. All right, we're getting everybody onto the plexiglass rocks here. So okay. Oh. She's going to get it.
This moment I don't totally understand.
Oh, he just kind of grazes her.
Yeah. How does that girl not dead?
No, I don't know. Supposedly what? Shark skin is incredibly rough.
Like
if you touched it, it's not razor sharp, but it's very, very rough. And it's like sandpaper.
Sandpaper, yeah.
Yeah. Everybody, those rocks don't look remotely real. Now that I'm looking at it again, I'm like, oh yeah, those rocks look completely fake. But okay,
yeah.
Oh, here he's gonna get the.
It's supposedly ding. That island was very difficult to like get any kind of traction on, so the kids just kept slipping off.
Yeah,
like, a really hard time just staying on it.
He's got an idea. Okay.
Man, they really forecast this. This
look at that! Oh my God! Is that Shiner? That's probably not Shiner. That is obviously, but that far away shot. I'm guessing that's a stunt man.
I would love it if it was.
I can't imagine that it would be. If he was having that right there, I bet it's not. I mean, if he was having that much trouble with Janos work, I can't imagine. Yeah, no, that's not him. That's a stunt guy. He keeps his face away from the camera, so. Okay. Oh, here we go. Dun, 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 dun. Oh, he's rearing up. Ah.
Oh, God.
Another zoom in. Yeah, they are showing a little too much of the shark at this point. We are.
The puppet mouth is a little too much.
Here we go. I'm going to bang. Boom. Boom.
Right, because we learned earlier in the movie that sharks are attracted to noise.
Of course.
Yeah, suddenly Brody's an expert on bite radiuses and what attracts great white sharks.
Oh, more of her quivering. They had a lot of B-roll of her quivering, I think.
They really do. I'm surprised she didn't become like a bigger like scream queen in the
80s. Yeah, yeah.
She sells it well. I mean,
yeah, she does. She does. Yeah. Now, again, how these wires can survive at the bottom of ocean water, salt water, for decades on end, but somehow a shark's tooth can pierce them is.
Well, I would love to know. Like, I'm no expert on these things, but I would love to know if an island out off of Amity Island like this, as like an electrical, like, power center, you know what I mean? Like, is this realistic? Why would it be on a little island out there in the middle of nothing?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would that be the best way to do that? Maybe these things do exist, but I have no knowledge of that whatsoever. It doesn't seem to be the most efficient way to do this.
And what happens if, you know, you have a leak?
Right.
You know, where do you know how to fix it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is a big ocean here.
The book's climax is very similar. Brody is not the action hero that he is here. The shark just kind of grabs an electrical wire by accident. And
oh, jeez. Wow, that's kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah, yeah. And the first book has a pretty anticlimactic ending as well.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But anyway, the climax happens at the lighthouse.
Okay. So
I find it a little more believable that there might be electrical.
Sure.
Course sure. Near the lighthouse where you need power.
Yep. This, here we go. Here's the big. Brody's got to time this exactly right, or he's crispy fried as well. He's got to really. I love how the shark rears up for no good reason, I guess, but right there. Oh, okay. Zonk. It really is the 4th of July.
Yeah, we got fun.
Pop, pop, pop. What are you screaming about? This is good. This is good news. What are you kids yelling about? Look at him. Oh, fwomph. Oh, there. Okay. Hey, Dad did it. There were just a couple extra beats, a little more. The shark burning up.
I mean, they got plenty of footage of that.
Yeah, they did.
From my understanding is when they shot this scene, they were like down to the last few minutes of light left before the sun went down.
Oh, geez. So yeah, we got to get this.
Yeah. So they were like, just get as much footage as we can.
Yay.
You know, it wasn't so obvious to me when I watched this last night, but yeah, a lot of these shots don't match up in terms of daylight.
Right. Yeah. Some. It's overcast. It's sunny. Yeah.
Well, until you mentioned it a few scenes ago, I never really thought about it. But you're right.
Yeah. There we go. All right. Now at this point, Amity's ruined.
You would think
Amity's done as a vacation resort. It's done because now they have established that sharks just come here regularly to eat people. So that's it. We're done. Amity's over. Which, I mean, that, I will say that is the one positive thing about Jaws 3 is that they don't replicate Amity in Jaws 3. They at least try something different.
Sure.
Well, all right. We've struck credits. I mean, look, like we said at the top of second unit director Joe Alves, he would go on to direct the third film. You know, look, this is not a great movie, but it is a relatively, I'd say, passable horror film with a shark in it. And I'd say existing by itself outside of the context of Jaws 2, it's a fun horror movie. Not great, but it's fun. But it's only because it is called Jaws 2 and it has the misfortune of following a masterpiece that it is, you know, regarded the way it is because it is just, it is a very thin follow-up to what is one of the great American films of all time. But like I say, by itself, it's fun. And then, of course, compared to the sequels that would follow, I mean, Jaws 3 makes Jaws 2 look like Jaws, is what I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I nitpicked a lot because, you know, I figured this is the time to do it.
Yeah, who else is going to do an audio commentary track for Jaws 2?
Yeah, I feel like I said a lot of negative things about it, but at the end of the day, I think you're spot on. I think that if this weren't Jaws 2, if this were, a different shark movie, like this would be right at home with a lot of, like, other drive-in fare that was coming out at that time.
Grizzly.
Orca.
The gods, Orca. Yeah. It would have been nature attacks movies.
Yes. It's only because it is part of the Jaws franchise that, you know, people tend to look negatively towards it.
Yeah.
Now, it's, again, not a perfect movie. I think there's definitely a lot of problems with it. I think it's longer than it used to be, which means it drags at certain points. But a lot of the shark sequences, I can't think of a shark sequence in this movie that I really don't have fun watching.
And yes, those are all fun. Those are all fun, absolutely. Yeah. So I like the giant fiberglass shark. So
it does deliver on the carnage.
It sure does. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, well, everybody, that is Jaws 2. Dan, thank you once again for joining me on this July 4th holiday. We've now made it 2 years in a row, so I'm guessing we'll be back next year for Jaws 3.
I will make sure to have my 3D glasses for that one.
That's going to be a rough one. That's going to be a rough one. So, well, everybody, thanks so much for listening to this Jaws 2 audio commentary. Of course, we're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod, and you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, and all the back episodes of the show are on the website, FireAndWaterPodcast.com. And finally, if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Neil Whitney for his support of the Film and Water Podcast. Neil, you helped make Jaws 2 happen. I hope you're proud of yourself. So that's going to do it. Everybody enjoy your July 4th holiday. For Christ's sakes, tomorrow's the 4th of July. So enjoy it. And again, Dan, thanks so much for joining me. And we will see everybody later. And until the next episode, that's a wrap.
Seaweed?
I don't know. What is it?
It's underwater, isn't it? That's why it's so dark.
There's nothing I can see.
What are you talking about? Look at this.
That's a shark. Look at the outline. Look at the mouth, the eyes.
Is that what it is? Sorry, I just don't see it.
Neither do I. It's nothing.
Martin, it could be anything.
Wait a minute. Are you people telling me I don't know what a shark looks like?
Brody, this is nothing. Seaweed, mud, something in the lens.
Lens my ass.
You're damn right it's your ass.
Now, be reasonable, please.
Reasonable what? With him?
God damn it, will you listen to the man? Will you just listen to him? Be reasonable. Look, Brody, you started a panic on a public beach. You shot up the damn place. God knows who you could have injured. Now, what if somebody decides to sue us? Did you ever stop to think about that? It could ruin us.
You don't have to worry about being sued or being ruined.
If this turns out to be what I think it is, because there won't be anybody here.
Yeah, now, Martin, let's not...
Let's not what, Larry? What?
Oh, Jesus, Larry, huh? Come on, let's just forget it. He won't listen. It's obvious the man has made up his mind.
You bet your life I've made up my mind. But I'm telling you, and I'm telling everybody at this table, that that's a shark. And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one because I don't intend to go through that hell again.